We are joined now by Kat Warren. She's a professor of English at NC State University and the author of What the Dog Knows, Scent, Science, and the Amazing Ways Dogs Perceive the World. The Young Readers edition of her New York Times bestseller comes out this fall. Kat, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me, Anita.
So you're someone with a deep history of relationships with dogs, as we've been talking about, incredibly complicated relationships we have with these animals. We consider them parts of our family. Tell me about your dog, Solo.
So the reason Solo came into my life is that I love German Shepherds, and I'd had two German Shepherds, and my husband David and I were looking for another shepherd to join our lives, and I was looking for a dog who would lie under my desk while I was writing, and then when I wanted a break, I would go out in the yard and throw a ball, and then he'd come back and rest under the table. And Solo, when he arrived, was the polar opposite of that kind of a dog. He kind of barreled into our lives, and I remember the first night that we had him, my arms were just covered with puppy puncture wounds. He'd just gone nuts. And he was in his crate, and I had this fabric crate that my earlier German Shepherd had been perfectly content in. And I could hear Solo growling and chewing his way out of the crate. And I literally was crying in David's arms, saying, "But I don't like him." And David said, "Oh, honey, it's okay. We'll just return him."
And that's a complicated decision, we all know. So he has all of this energy. You spend a lot of time thinking about what to do with it, how to channel it. Eventually, you decide to train him as a cadaver dog. So tell us what a cadaver dog does and a bit about the process of training Solo.
So the term cadaver dog really describes what a cadaver dog does. And that's a dog specifically trained to locate the missing and the dead. And it sounds like grim work, but for the dog, and inevitably for the person at the under the end of the leash, it is a joyous experience, because what you do is you train the dog to recognize the scent of human remains and then reward them with whatever they think is the most wonderful reward in the world, be it a tug toy, which was what Solo loved, or some dogs are actually trained with and rewarded with treats. Bloodhounds, when they're being trained very often, and it's still funny, people will have a can of Spam or sausages, juicy sausages at the end of the trail, and open them up and reward the bloodhound with those when they're in training.
So there's so much that goes into this training. And one of the things that struck me when reading your book is how this dog is really programmed for a mission, and you really want the dog to be able to complete the mission. But to do that, they have to be able to avoid distractions. So how do you train a dog to avoid a distraction that we think of as kind of innate, like a squirrel or another dog or a juicy hamburger that happens to be on the side of the road?
Right. So it's this, in some ways, it's the same way. I think the easiest thing that people might recognize is that as you train border collies to herd sheep, right, there's this process where the dogs are both bred for and then exposed to sheep. And over time, it goes on, the game goes on longer and longer. And the dog, in a sense, begins to be rewarded by that, the game itself. And the same is true of scent detection dogs, is that ultimately the ignoring of distractions gets built in because they are having such pleasure in the work of finding a particular scent. And they're both aware of the reward at the end of the game, but they're not thinking just about that. They end up being very engaged and rewarded by the search itself. And so not all dogs are capable of it. As you say, I mean, some dogs, the squirrel is just always going to be a better end game than the reward for finding the scent. And that's part of the challenge of finding a dog that has that stick-to-itiveness, but also training that, which is why you constantly train.
So talk about scent detection and the biology and structure of a dog's nose that allows for them to have this capacity. So I know they're able to kind of release scents through the side of their nose. They can fill up with more kind of sensory information. Tell me about this biology.
I mean, the biology, we're still learning about it. And, you know, if you look at the book, it's still true that people say the dog's noses are 10 times or 100 times or 1,000 times or 10,000 times better than humans. And humans actually have pretty good noses. But dogs can actually sniff in stereo. So part of the way they're able to locate a particular scent is that their nostrils can operate independently, for one thing, and then they can take in air over these little turbinates in a way where when we sniff, the air doesn't get separated out in that way. So as scientists go about developing an artificial nose that's as good as a dog's nose, they're literally turning to the physiology of the dog's nose to look at what the ideal design might be.
So you have revamped your original book, What the Dog Knows, to be written for a young adult audience or young readers. And I'd like to ask you to read a section for us that gives us a sense of what it's like when Solo is hard at work and on the job. So if you want to set this up for us and then read.
So I'll set this up a little. And this was a couple years after I had started training him. And this is the first dog I had trained to be a scent detection dog. And so a couple of chapters in the book relate one of the searches that we did in this area where somebody had run from the police and had gone missing and hadn't been heard from for 3 days. And of course, my job was to be not nervous so that Solo could do his job. So I'll take it from there. The two investigators, Solo and I, ducked under the yellow crime tape, climbed through a jagged hole in a chain-link fence, and entered the shade of the mimosas and elderberries and trees of heaven that overwhelmed the edges of these woods. We straightened up on the other side, and I took one of the rope tug toys out of the training bag and then tucked it into my pocket. Solo yowled and spun, kneecapping me with his big shoulder. I winced and unhooked his lead. I reminded myself once again that searches were not the time for etiquette lessons. I didn't want Solo to sit or heel or watch me with adoration. I wanted him to find the suspect, who was now surely a victim. Freed, and far more obedient off-lead than on, Solo stood frozen, waiting, his eyes fixed forward, then sliced back to my pocket that held the tug toy, then shifted down the hill again. The slope was littered with empty liquor bottles, disposable diapers, a shattered big wheel, an ancient washing machine. He didn't need to hear the command, but the words focused and centered me, reminding me that we'd rehearsed this game. The least I could do was get it started. And my command was, go find your fish, which is just, it could be, I like that chair. It doesn't matter what the command is as long as the dog was aware. Solo, go find your fish. He did a final brief dance around me, striking the pocket where I'd stashed the toy with his open muzzle. Not a bite. It hurt, though. Then he barked sharply and disappeared into the dense undergrowth.
That was Kat Warren reading from her forthcoming Young Readers edition of What the Dog Knows, Scent, Science, and the Amazing Ways Dogs Perceive the World. So there's so much going on there, and there's this really interesting interplay of energy between you and Solo, and you really have to learn just as much as he does how to go about this process. Can you talk about that, the dynamic between you and Solo, and how that plays into being able to do this work?
When I talk about that dance between the dog and the human, it's learning how to partner with a dog so that the dog's strengths, which is working independently, having a great nose, able to play this game, which is essentially a complicated game of hunting for something, but also you're being the one who is helping him do the very best job he can, which means you're directing a little bit because you're searching areas where it may be hard for the dog to search. You've trained so that the dog doesn't skip over something if it's out there. And you're also working hard so that the dog has the best possible time, right? Doesn't overheat, thinks it's fun, doesn't get exhausted or discouraged. And all of that goes into it. So that's what you're thinking about when you're out there handling the dog.
So when we think about these moments when it's you and Solo and you're trying to read his cues and he's trying to read your cues, how much do dogs who are not trained for this have that same kind of capacity to maintain eye contact or to get signals from their human owner?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about eye contact is it really is one of those things that we now know is so hardwired into both of us, right? The fact is that, and people know this, they look at their dogs, the dog stares back, the dog starts grinning, you start grinning, and they've really discovered that that feedback loop of oxytocin, right, or that feel-good chemical works with dogs and humans.
So I'm not projecting. My dog
The dog is smiling back. And part of that is so important because that's the bond you develop with the dog. With a search dog, you actually want that dog to be working independently. So as much as possible, that eye contact thing is not where I said I didn't want him staring at me adoringly. I wanted him out doing his job, right? That bonding time comes after. What was interesting with Solo is that once he had found what he was looking for, he would immediately give me eye contact and or literally come bounding back so that he could stare at me and then go back to where the training material was. And that's how I knew he'd found it, because he said, okay, I can bond now.
So in his off time, how did you balance the relationship between him as a worker and him as your pet?
You know, a lot of people have very different feelings about this. There are people who have working dogs where they actually say that it's not great that these are working dogs. They're not pets. For all the great handlers and great dogs that I've seen, the fact is there is a real bond. And I didn't worry about Solo at home getting loved on or having access to toys or any of that. The fact is that he loved to work and he loved to relax at home. And we were lucky that way.
And you've rewritten your book for kids. What do you hope kids take away from reading and learning about Solo?
I think this is for 8 to 12-year-olds. And to me, it's this combination of thinking about the countryside as a kind of open-air museum, of getting out, of understanding nature and all its beauty, and sometimes a little bit in its grimness, but mostly in its beauty. And the degree to which kids can get excited about science through an animal that most of them actually already love. And so I look at the dog as a kind of big furry laboratory. Don't experiment in bad ways with your dog, but the degree to which you can actually observe and play with and understand a whole lot of biology and psychology and nature through dogs is what drove me to adapt this.
Kat Warren is a professor of English at NC State University. She's the author of the New York Times bestseller, What the Dog Knows, Scent, Science, and the Amazing Ways Dogs Perceive the World. The Young Readers Edition comes out this October. Kat, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Just ahead, where can you find one of the world's rarest butterflies? Try the Fort Bragg Artillery Range. We'll talk with the biologists and military experts collaborating to defend our country from threats, both human and natural. I'm Anita Rao. Please stay with us.